stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. It appears a bailout of Greece's economy has fallen apart. The finance ministers of the Eurozone have rejected a Greek request to extend the deadline of its bailout program until after a planned July 5th referendum. The ministers held an emergency meeting Saturday after Greece said the outcome of bailout talks would be put to a national referendum. Speaking to reporters before the meeting began, Finland's finance minister, Alexander Stubb, expressed his disappointment.
I think this is potentially a very sad day, specifically for the Greek people. I think with the announcement of this referendum, we're basically closing the door for any further negotiations. There is a pretty much consensus inside the Eurogroup that we cannot extend the program as it stands. And consequently, I would argue that Plan B becomes Plan A.
The German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, had a similar reaction. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras received a standing ovation Saturday in Parliament, which convened to debate the government's request for a referendum. A vote was scheduled. Mr. Tsipras made the announcement in a televised address to the nation late on Friday. Greece needs an $8 billion installment of an EU economic bailout to repay nearly $2 billion in loans to the International Monetary Fund by next Tuesday. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Iran nuclear negotiators are hopeful they will be able to reach an agreement, but they still need to work through some very tough issues. He commented in Vienna on Saturday as he launched a series of closed-door talks with the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Jarif Jarif. This is VOA News. World leaders have joined in their condemnation of three terror attacks across three continents Friday, which left dozens dead in the space of a few hours. The White House and nations around the world described the assaults in Tunisia, France, and Kuwait as horrific acts of terrorism.
A sunny day in the Tunisian beach resort of Sousse turned into a bloodbath when an attacker gunned down dozens of tourists. Almost simultaneously, a suicide bomber blew himself up in a Shiite mosque in Kuwait, killing more than 20 people. The attack was claimed by Islamic State extremists. In France, an attacker beheaded a businessman and left his decapitated body daubed with Arabic writing at the entrance of a U.S.-based gas company. The killings came just days after an Islamic State spokesman called on the group's followers to carry out attacks against all infidels. Analysts say even if Islamic State did not directly coordinate the attacks, the group encourages anyone to claim affiliation, allowing it to claim credit. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Washington.
An official in Pakistan says the devastating week-long heat wave in the southern port city of Karachi has killed over 1,000 people. Nazir Mohammad Bazdar, the operations director of the Provincial Disaster Management Authority, said Saturday that 65,000 heat stroke patients were treated at his city's hospitals since June 20th when the heat wave struck Sindh province and its capital of Karachi. He told the Associated Press that 1,923 patients with heat-related ailments are still being treated. Although temperatures in Karachi Saturday came down to 34 degrees Celsius after touching 45 degrees a week ago amid chronic power outages, the heat wave struck Karachi at a time when the city's Muslim majority was observing the dawn-to-dusk fasting month of Ramadan. Gunmen have attacked a military camp in western Mali Saturday, exchanging shots with soldiers as residents of a nearby village hid in their homes, according to officials and witnesses. The attack began around 5 in the morning at the camp near the village of Nara, about 50 kilometers from the border with Mauritania, according to an army spokesman. Casualty information was not immediately available, and the assailants were unknown, said the spokesman. However, a source in Mali's intelligence service, who spoke on condition of anonymity because he wasn't authorized to speak to the media, said the gunmen were Islamic militants linked to Ansar Dine. The shooting death of one escaped killer brought new energy to a three-week hunt for a jailbreak partner as helicopters, search dogs, and hundreds of law enforcement officers converged on a wooded area in upstate New York that once held them. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Our President Muhammadu Buhari has been informed that there are billions of US dollars of Nigerian money that has been siphoned and taken abroad.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari vows to recover billions of dollars of stolen public funds siphoned out of the country.
Our expectation as large, and I'm very sure as other constitutional stakeholders in the country, is that Mr. Lungu has a tenure only up to 2016 next year, as provided for in the constitution.
The chairman of the Zambian Law Association urges calm following controversy surrounding constitutional term limits.
This is not how our governments work in democracies. The business of laws and law enforcement is done by the Justice Department.
And will the arrest of the Rwandan spy chief in the United Kingdom ruin the warm diplomatic relationship between London and Kigali? We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is committed to recovering billions of dollars of stolen state funds embezzled and siphoned out of the country by former officials. Presidential spokesman Garba Shehu says officials from the United States and other European countries have pledged support in Mr. Buhari's bid to recover and repatriate funds stolen from the West African country. Garba Shehu told me President Buhari is determined to use the recovered funds to improve the living conditions of Nigerians.
This is following assurances that the president has received from leading countries of Europe and the United States of America. Their leaders say that they will support Nigeria to recover stolen funds. Our President Muhammadu Buhari has been informed that there are billions of US dollars of Nigerian money that has been siphoned and taken abroad. Money that is recoverable, given, you know, some processes. And our President has said he's ready to undertake those processes and see how well that will yield to the country, considering, you know, the parlous state of the economy, and the treasury being in dire straits. Money in US dollars would do miracles for Nigeria.
The government has expressed concerns that the coffers are empty. However, the former finance minister is saying that it's not debt incurred by necessarily the federal government, but state government are to blame for this. How is the president coming up with plans to resolve this problem? Because he made promises that he needs to keep. How does he keep his promise with the coffers being empty?
Well, two things. One is that the minister is talking about the foreign reserves. I think the question to have put to him is, how much did they inherit? How come they left barely about half of what they found? And other than that, what else is there? So that's a question to answer. Secondly, President Buhari made promises on the basis of which, of course, we won the election. He will strive. He will do 100% effort, even if that doesn't yield 100% results. Now, the thing is, Nigerians are also very reasonable people. We will run a government that is open and transparent. They will be shown all of the numbers, and they will see that the effort is being made. And I'm sure that where we come short in terms of meeting up on our promises, the good people of Nigeria will show that understanding.
Looking at the expectations, the president has also promised improved security, cracking down on Boko Haram. There has been frequent attacks on the civilians. What is the current situation and how serious is the president's commitment to get rid of these terrorist groups?
Well, you can see that from the moment he took power, President Buhari has spent more time on Boko Haram issues than on anything, including possibly his own hours of sleep. He has visited all the neighboring countries, well, Cameroon is on the queue. He's talked to the leaders and the Chad Basin, and they have plans for the deployment of the multinational joint task force with enormous goodwill and support for weaponry and the refurbishment of existing armament from the rich countries, the G7. So we're doing well as far as that one is concerned. As for the attacks that you are witnessing, Muhammad Buhari did not say he would wish away. It can't be wished away. He never had said that it will go with a wave of the hand. And the reports we are getting from the armed services is that indicate that actually there's a lot of pressure on the Boko Haram in their own declared haven, the territory they control, which is the Sambisa forest. They're being pushed out of that place, and territory is being taken back. So these are splinters that are abandoning the forest, their own haven, and making their way into some of our cities and villages and creating this havoc. So they are struggling to be there, to be noticed. These are matters of time. I think that with the time and the progress that is being made, it's a matter of time because before this is all over.
The president has met the media. Will this be something that he intends to do to keep Nigerians abreast with what he plans to do or what he is doing?
It's a milestone in the affairs of the Nigerian presidency, where after our meeting with them, the press corps of the presidency informed them that the president that no past Nigerian president had ever had this sort of meeting with the president. It's amazing. But there it was. And President Buhari has given the commitment that these meetings will be sustained. There will be periodic interactions with the press corps of the State House. And after that, our window to the rest of the country. So you can just, we take the responsibility very seriously.
Garba Shehu is the spokesman for the Nigerian President Muhammad Buhari. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Chairman of the Law Association of Zambia, or LAZ, has urged citizens not to panic after an attorney petitioned a court arguing that President Edgar Lungu was elected to serve a full 5-year term. President Lungu won a presidential by-election to fill out the term of Michael Sata, who died in January this year. Mr. Sata's 5-year term in office would have ended in 2016. LAZ Chairman George Chisanga told me that the current constitution is clear in stipulating that the winner of the presidential by-election can only complete the remaining term of the deceased predecessor.
I have told the country to remain at ease while this application is proceeding in court. But I have told them, without in any way suggesting that I'm giving an opinion on the matter which is in court, that the existing constitutional position is that a president who takes over the office of president via an election or a by-election after the passing on of the incumbent is only allowed under the constitution to run the remainder of the tenure of the president who has died and whom he has succeeded. So our expectation as LAZ, and I'm very sure as other constitutional stakeholders in the country, is that Mr. Lungu has a tenure only up to 2016 next year as provided for in the constitution.
There is a precedent before when President Patrick Levi-Wanawasa died somebody took over because of a by-election that was held. His vice president came to office and all that. Why is this all of a sudden pushed behind the banner? Isn't this entrenched in Zambia's constitution?
In fact, somebody had asked a very funny question when the press queries were being sent to me. Somebody was saying, why didn't the Patriotic Front at that time make an application to court to extend Mr. Rupiah Banda's tenure for 5 years? Because he had been elected, you know, in the same manner that Mr. Lungu has been elected. But as you rightly pointed out, Peter, this is an entrenched constitutional provision. And as you stated, We had a very rich precedent in the country whereby, you know, when Mr. Manuasa State Council passed on, we went to a by-election that brought into office President Sophia Banda. And we only ran for the tenure to finish the five-year term that was started under Mr. Manuasa. After Mr. Sophia Banda, we had a general election in which Mr. Sasa was elected. And unfortunately, again, we had a state funeral, as the nation, as the world is aware. But after the state funeral, we have had another election in which we ushered, His Excellency President Edgar Sagalungu. On the understanding clearly that in strict compliance with the Constitution, he will run the tenure only up 2016 when we have another general election.
What assurances is the Law Association of Zambia giving to the citizens, especially when they appear to be a little uncomfortable, and they have said so because of this seemingly controversy that is going on? They appear to be quite uncomfortable with this latest round of discussions about this constitutional provision.
As an individual, I quite understand the anxiety that people have received this kind of news. But as a professional lawyer and also, as a bar association in the country, we have immense confidence and trust in the justice system in our country. And we know that the judges are going to rise to the occasion. Without in any way suggesting that, the judge must be persuaded, I want to believe that the judges will correctly interpret the provisions of the Constitution and pay attention to the fact that there's an existing precedent in the country. And they will definitely decide the matter in strict accordance with the provisions of the Constitution. People just need to remain calm because, like I said, the profession, the law of Zambia, has immense confidence in the justice system in the country.
Do you know if the judges have indicated when they will rule on this matter?
As a matter of fact, this matter is still in the High Court. I'm given to understand it will be heard by a single judge of the High Court from which the right to appeal can be exercised. So it will be determined, and we're not aware of when the judge is going to. It's a very freshly filed matter. I think it's not more than 4 days, on the court record. So we are not sure when they will be determining it. But because constitutional matters are given the urgency that they deserve, we're very sure that within the shortest possible time, we'll hear, a ruling from the court on the matter.
George Chisanga is the chairman of the Law Association of Zambia, or LAZ. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Bulldozers razed hundreds of homes and businesses in Sodom and Gomorrah neighborhood of the Ghanaian capital, Accra, last Saturday. This, the city mayor Alfred Ni Okovandapoy says, will allow authorities to widen a lagoon to prevent a repeat of this month's deadly floods that left at least 150 people dead. For more on the current situation, Mr. Vandapoy joins us live via telephone link up. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor.
Yes, good afternoon.
How are you, sir? Hello?
Yes.
All right.
Now, can you hear me?
All right, yes, I can hear you now, Mr. Mayor. Let me ask you this. What measures are you putting in place to resolve this almost yearly deadly flooding in Accra?
Well, over the years, it's been government commitment that we should, dredge the Kali Lagoon. We should distill the drains. We should build the water retention reservoirs and build the covered drain that is needed so that when it rains, we will have the waterways cleared so that water can run into the appropriate places through the Adon River, into the Kali Lagoon, and into the ocean. So currently, we have massive desilting of drains going on in Accra. We have dredging of the Kali Lagoon that has also begun. And those two activities are on our gear to ensure that, any rain that will come down will have a way into entering into the Kali Lagoon and into the ocean. But in doing so, it became necessary that we demolish the structures, the legal structures that have been built over the years on the Kali Lagoon, where residents have filled virtually almost the Kali Lagoon and with sawdust and sand and have built on them.
So now, Mr. Mayor,
these structures.
Mr. Mayor, will all those structures go? Because critics have said that the destruction has been insensitive and there's no empathy, there's no compassion in this drive. What is your answer to that?
Well, I will not agree to that because over the years, you know, I have been mayor since 2009. I have met with the elders and leaders of the old Sadama community and those in the Sodom and Gomorrah area. And the negotiation have always been that there is the need for them to vacate the area because we cannot allow them to continue to live there whilst they virtually close the Colin Lagoon and water cannot enter into the open when it rains, which was the experience of June 3rd. The old Fadama we are living for now, the old Fadama is on a run, you understand? The elite structures that are in the Colin Lagoon and the Odo, which we normally refer to as the Sodom and Gomorrah, is what we are currently removing.
Now, Mr. Mayor, usually when desilting is done in Accra and parts of the country, they put the residue right beside whatever dredging it is. Now, what is different this time? Because when you put it close to where you already desilted, with the little amount of rain, it will go back to where you dug. So basically it's cost 90, as they say in Ghana, which is zero.
Yeah.
Hello?
I'm saying that in recent times, that practice has changed. We have moved away from that practice to where, you know, now when we desilt, what we do is that we collect all the residue that we have desilted and we are dumping it on a temporary site near the Colin Lagoon. And then we are taking it to the landfill in Osania, somewhere near in Sawam. So that is of just desilting and leaving it by the drains. No, we are not practicing that, please.
No, Mr. Mayor.
There's a massive desilting of the Odo River from the Kwame Nkrumah Circle all the way through the Graphic Road and into the Odo and into the Colin Lagoon. So those are materials we can never leave on the roadside.
Now, Mr. Mayor, can you assure residents of Accra that the next time it rains, lives will not necessarily be lost because of flooding and because waterways have been cleared?
Well, that is the objective now. That's the objective. That's why we are massively desilting and we are opening the waterways of the lagoon, the Odo River and the Colin Lagoon. But it remains for us to also construct the water retention reservoirs. We have not started the construction of that. And then also the drains. We have not done those too. But we are dredging the Odo River and the Colin Lagoon in hopes that when it rains, water will find its way right into the ocean.
Now, Mr. Mayor, briefly, there are suggestions that Accra is big enough to control the funds it raises to improve the city infrastructure needs, just like some cities in Western countries. What is your take, briefly, in 10 seconds?
Yes, I agree that Accra has the potential for that. But we need to change the valuation laws, you know, in calculating the revenue, you know, the property rates. And currently, we are working with the Ministry of Finance so that something can go to the Parliament for a change. When that happens, Accra can raise its own money and Accra will not have to depend on government on the common fund.
Thank you very much. Alfred New Okovandapoy is the mayor of the Ghanaian capital, Accra. He joined us live via telephone link up. The arrest this week of Rwandan spy chief in the UK over alleged war crimes is seen by some as a test to the relationship between the two countries. David Himbara, a former top economic aide to Rwandan President Paul Kagame, is the coordinator for the North American branch of Democracy in Rwanda now. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached Himbara in London and asked him the impact of this arrest on the otherwise close ties between London and Kigali.
The arrest of Karake Karenzi is not an act by British political leaders. This is not how our governments work in democracy. The business of laws and law enforcement is done by the Justice Department. So in this case, the people who arrested Karenzi is justice doing its work. The Rwandans are the ones who seem to misunderstand how government works. So this has nothing to do with the political, diplomatic relationship of countries.
Given General Karenzi's position, are you surprised that he didn't expect such an arrest to occur in the UK?
I think this shows actually arrogance of the government, not of the man himself, but the government. Well, the government knows that there are some indictments. You may recall that President Kagame himself, who faced a lawsuit in the United States, had to seek help from the Obama administration that actually applied for immunity for him to avoid the lawsuit. This is a government that actually always believes that the whole world is at their mercy. But these lawsuits are genuine. They are out there and they can be enforced.
What do you make of the arrest itself and the subsequent indictment?
I'm rather surprised. I would have thought myself that a case like this would actually help all parties involved. Karenzi himself have his day in court, in a credible court, so that this case is done with one way or the other. The government of Rwanda as well, I think, I would have thought it would benefit because this gives an opportunity to actually verify if indeed those indictments are bogus, as Rwandan says, or they are for real, because, again, they are being determined by very highly competent courts, RC and UK. And of course, then Britain also gains. Britain retains its reputation of, fair justice.
And then what do you make of the reaction of the Rwandan leadership of this arrest, right from the president, who had harsh words for the United Kingdom government and the West, and even to some people like you?
The president of Rwanda basically said that the British judicial sector is colonial, arrogant, and rubbish, and that it should be held in contempt. This is most unfortunate. The law is the law. So I think he mistakes the universal situation to his own situation, where he seems to be head of all the three branches of government: president, chief justice, and speaker of parliament. So now to go again inside the parliament of Rwanda and call individuals criminals and thugs, including myself, I think it's most unfortunate. It speaks volume about the leadership of Rwanda, really.
Over the last two decades, at least some people, Rwanda has been seemingly untouchable by the West, or any criticism of Rwanda has been taken to be out of bounds. Now, does this arrest change that, in your opinion?
President of Rwanda has done some amazing public relations in these countries, and he has very powerful friends that speak for him, former prime minister, former president, and very influential people. You also notice that the lawyer representing Karenzi, the head of the team, is the wife of Tony Blair. So Kagame's government is well-networked with these powerful individuals. But he has, I think, and his government have mistaken this now to mean the laws of these countries can be held hostage by a friendship. So I think that basically it's the things that are catching up with Rwanda, not the other way around.
David Himbara is a former top economic aide to Rwandan President Paul Kagame and coordinator for the North American branch of Democracy in Rwanda now. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from London. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Proto, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy. I don't get that lot, God you win. And I don't pay my rent, God you win. There be one for my hand, but God you win. There be one keep my joy, but God you win. I say anything empty, now God you win. No, now God you win. No, now God you win, no. I don't change my name to God you win. I no more, I don't buy more to God you win. I say my market no go sell, but God you win. And then me say I no go blue, but God you win. Them my brother, make them try their luck. My God go win, no my God go win, no my Lord go win, no. And little then do not God you win, no not God you win, no not God you win, no. As you don't pass exam, now God you win. And then me say you no go pass, for God you win. You wake up, see today last song, now God you win. Robbers, they rob, they no see you, my brother. They no see you, my sister. Oh, yeah, better pass. Now God you win. No, now God you win. No, now God you win. As now your wedding day, now God you win. And he don't tell where you get fine, but God you win. See, we go pop champagne today, God you win. And we go there, dance, 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 cause God you win. Oh, elelele, anything you win, now God you win. And if you win election, my brother, God you win. Like if you win the contract, my friend, now God you win. And if you check the countdown, my brother, God you win. And if your market's a lelelele, now God you win. No, now God you win. No, now God you win, no.
Ronaldo. The thing that's sweeter like Don Jose Minado. Orlando. She just a holla, she just scream of Brigado. As I the fire, I the call her Molato. My Molato.
Oh yeah, baby, make we collabo. I know you want the collabo. Hey, yeah, I go sing for you, you go sing for me.
Na collabo, she wants a collabo.
Oh yeah, baby, make we collabo. I know you want the collabo. Hey, yeah, I go sing for you, you go sing for me.
Na collabo, she wants a collabo.
Yeah,
as I don't show, guy, she know they regret no more. How I know?
How I know?
Molato give unto me, come they get down low. My brain is scatter, I'm insane, cause I don't know.
I don't know.
And I don't blow, like say no tomorrow. If I don't get money, I get place to borrow. Say you dey feel me, you dey form, say you no know. I get your password and you know, say I don't go. Me, I don't go.
Oh yeah, baby, make we collabo. I know you want the collabo. Hey, yeah, I go sing for you, you go sing for me.
Na collabo, she wants a collabo.
Oh yeah, baby, make we collabo. I know you want the collabo. Hey, yeah, I go sing for you, you go sing for me.
Na collabo, she wants a collabo.
Yeah,
yeah. Baby, you are carry come. But now you are go carry go. Sisi agbari go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe you are the tech on no. But now you are one and no, 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 no. Sisi Ferrari, oh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very sweet, yeah. Very nice, yeah. Very toody-doody-doo. Body quite tight. Show me what sexy. Man, I don't know you're running. But you must go there, wapa. Oh, I feel like you're saying. But you, yeah, 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 yeah. You are what to marry. Sisi agbari go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Baby, you are the giver, yo. But now you are what to give my life to, baby, yo.
Oh, oh, oh.
Very sweet, yeah. Very nice, yeah. Very tootie-tootie-doo. Body quite tight. Show me what sexy. Man, I don't know you're running. What's in my code, wapa. Oh, I feel my mood, I say me. What you want?
Baby, let's be some love tonight. Gifts,
Anything I do, you do, baby, my way, I dance and go crazy, baby, anything I say,
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy in Africa, and at the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. Every week, I pay close attention to developments in U.S. policy towards Africa, and I also look at developments in Africa, and I see how those developments are going to affect American policy. This week, a number of issues are already debated at the Congress, in the media, and in Africa. AGOA is back. AGOA, it came from the Clinton administration. It's certainly one of the legacies of former President Bill Clinton. So the U.S. Congress and Senate decided this week to give a 10-year life to AGOA. So AGOA will be with us for the next 10 years, thanks to the legislation out of the Congress. So many of the African governments are going to be debating among themselves in their summits and in their respective meetings on how AGOA is going to be related to African development in the next 10 years. And I expect to hear more and more debates in the African media and in the American media focusing on international affairs. But AGOA is not the only issue. There are many developments going on in the United States this past week or month. Two issues that are developments within American politics, and they are going to reverberate in African politics. The first one is climate change. Climate change has been with the U.S. government under many presidents. You can go back to President Bush Senior when he tried to deal with climate change with the Latin American countries. When the event took place in Latin America, there were problems with the Japanese. And of course, now most importantly, the problem of climate change deals with Europe, African Union, China, India, and many other countries. The African countries are going to be caught up, if not already caught up, with this debate about climate change. The Africans, of course, are going to be affected not because they are successfully doing well with industrialization, such as the Chinese and the Indians, the Brazilians, and other members of the BRIC nations, including the former Soviet Union, now Russia. So climate change is going to be another issue in Africa, because the Africans want to develop. But if they want to develop like the Chinese and the Indians, their leaders have to pay close attention to the debate on climate change. So that is going to be an area the Africans will have to deal with in their own way through their summits. So hopefully when they come back to America, if President Obama is willing to advise them to come here before the end of his term, be rest assured that the Africans who are going to negotiate with American companies, if climate change is going to be a big issue in American policy, just like American government put a lot of restraints on American corporations dealing with other countries when corruption became a big issue. And of course, the Germans established an international NGO, Transparency International, to address the question of corruption. That issue is still ongoing in many of the African countries. So when you talk about climate change, political corruption, and abuse of natural resources in different countries, many of the NGOs that are concerned about climate change and are very concerned about human rights, such as Amnesty International, they are going to be caught up in this issue. The other issue that is relevant in understanding U.S. policy towards Africa and to look at African opinions on and attitudes towards U.S. policy, you have to pay close attention to details within the United States. Besides climate change, there is a fundamental issue now in America, which is right debated among Americans. It has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court. And this is the gay issue, gay movement, which is already a problem in African countries. There are certain African leaders who have come out very strongly against the gay movement. The president of Zimbabwe, the president of Uganda, and the president of the Gambia, among many others. Even in Nigeria, there were some legislators who went to action. And you see that in many other African countries. So besides climate change, there is the question of the gay groups. The president of the Gambia, Yahya Jammeh, came out strongly at the UN when he came out and made his statements. We did not ring very well with the gay movement in the United States. And of course, the human rights issue, corruption, maladministration are all beginning to be lumped into a single issue in some of these African countries. So when you talk about American policy towards Africa, you have to pay close attention to some of the political issues that are being debated in the U.S. government. When people talk about term limits, as we have been saying over and over again, you now have to pay attention to climate change, which has no significant impact in African countries because African countries are yet to industrialize, except in South Africa maybe, which is more advanced than many of them. But the ones who want to move forward towards industrialization will have to deal with climate change. But the gay issue, which is definitely opposed by many African religious groups, the Catholic Church, which is a major church, but there are Protestant groups. Although many Protestant organizations have reconciled with the gay groups. And today, when the Supreme Court of the United States came in support of gay marriages, you can see the global impact of that policy in terms of U.S. relations with many African countries and many other countries around the world. So the debate has started. Now you have U.S. Supreme Court authority legitimizing certain things. And that makes a big difference. If you want to understand this reality, you have to remember South African apartheid since 48. And when you have changes in America with regard to civil rights movement, South Africa gradually began to suffer from the changes that were taking place in America with regard to race relations. So the big struggle has started. So climate change and the gay groups in America are going to affect U.S. policy in Africa and beyond. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a man who hangs around a beautiful girl without saying a word ends up fetching water on her wedding day. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Organization of American States, or OAS, is an inclusive, hemispheric organization, the oldest international organization in the world, uniting nearly a billion people in the Caribbean and South Central and North America. Its purpose is to achieve among its members an order of peace and justice, to promote their solidarity, to strengthen their collaboration, and to defend their sovereignty, their territorial integrity, and their independence. It is the premier, most inclusive political, juridical, and social governmental forum in the Americas, whose member states have made an explicit commitment to uphold democracy, respect human rights, and cooperate on matters of security and development. Speaking at the 45th General Assembly in mid-June, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, "Together we are working to realize a vision for the Americas, where countries share responsibilities, cooperate as equals, and advance common interests and values. The OAS is integral to this future. We can all take enormous pride in the example that the Americas have set for the entire world." Deputy Secretary Blinken emphasized the hemisphere's great strides in recent years, stating,
"In this young century, the hemisphere has seen significant, even transformational change, from exclusive to inclusive societies, from authoritarian to democratic governments, from closed to open economies. The Americas are peaceful, overwhelmingly democratic, and increasingly prosperous."
The Deputy Secretary emphasized the importance of OAS reform, noting,
"We must strengthen responsible stewardship and good governance in our own national governments and within the OAS, including its associated and constituent offices. This means shaping a more focused and fortified secretariat that faithfully reflects the strategic vision statement, advances an agenda for reform, and refocuses on the OAS's core thematic pillars. And it means taking a stand against corruption and acts of betrayal by public officials in our own countries that undermine democratic institutions and the sacred trust of our people."
In this time of change, the founding principles of the organization remain as enduring and as relevant as the day the OAS Charter was first drafted, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. "We remain committed to those bedrock principles and ideals of democracy, security, and development for all of our citizens."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.